Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is pretty specific, and frankly, it confronts one of the largest, darkest questions hanging over translational neuroscience.
Right.
Why, after decades of foundational research and billions of dollars, do we keep failing so spectacularly when it comes to treatments for neurodegenerative diseases?
And for you, the learner, this is, you know, a crucial question. You're already deep in the fundamentals. You know you're alpha-synuclein from your tau, you get the amyloid cascade.
You're familiar with the biomarkers.
Exactly. So this is the moment to look past the pathology itself and really examine the drug discovery process, because that's where the problem is.
It really is. I mean, the reality is drug success rates in Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, they are just devastatingly low. We hit dead ends in phase three over and over again.
And we're not just here to state that problem. We're here to understand the solution that's being built right now in the lab.
Okay, so what is that solution? What's the core issue?
The uncomfortable truth, the sort of dirty secret of NDD research, is that we've been operating under a totally false premise, which is that Alzheimer's is one disease or that Parkinson's is one disease. They're not. They are collections of maybe 50 or more biologically distinct conditions, all just grouped under a single diagnostic umbrella.
And that's where the failure starts.
That's where it starts. So our mission today is to understand how induced pluripotent stem cells, iPSCs, and cerebral organoids are finally giving us the patient-specific models we need to unravel this huge biological mess.
Okay, so before we get into the tools themselves, let's nail down this paradigm shift you're talking about, this move toward personalized medicine.
Mm.
If we define it as the right treatment for the right patient, well, that sounds incredibly difficult, maybe even prohibitively expensive, right?
It is difficult, no question. And the cost is something we have to talk about. But the current model, the one that guarantees repeated failure, is already completely unsustainable.
So what is personalized medicine exactly?
Yeah, it's delivering a treatment based on that one individual's unique biological, genetic, environmental, and, you know, lifestyle profile. It's really the only rational approach once you accept how diverse the pathology is.
Let's break down that shift then. We began with what you call empirical medicine.
Right. One drug for an entire population. Here's a pill for Alzheimer's.
And where are we now? What's the intermediate step?
We're moving pretty quickly through what's called stratified medicine. Here we use biomarkers, so things like genetic markers, neuroimaging, biofluids, to group patients into evidence-based clusters.
So like treating patients with the APOE4 allele differently from people who don't carry it.
Exactly that. That's stratification. It's a huge improvement over the empirical model, but you're still dealing with large predefined groups.
And the final goal, the real leap, is to personalize medicine itself.
That's where we're headed. The aim is for individual treatments for each patient. And this is the key driven, not just by population evidence, but by patient-derived evidence.
Ah, and that's the link to the models.
That's the crucial link. We have to have models that authentically capture the pathology of one specific person. If we can't do that, we can't screen a drug for them. We certainly can't predict how they'll react to a therapy.
Okay, so let's unpack that. If personalized modeling is the solution, then this this heterogeneity of the human brain pathology in NDDs is the core problem.
It is.
Just how overwhelming is this biological variation? Mm-hmm. Why is it sinking our clinical trials?
I mean, we can't stress this enough. The differences are profound. A massive clinical trial. It could cost hundreds of millions of dollars, and it might fail not because the drug was bad, but because, say, 80% of the patients in the trial had a pathology that the drug was never even designed to address.
Wow.
Let's start with what we call pathological and diagnostic uncertainty.
Which basically means the clinical label Alzheimer's disease is often a really weak proxy for the underlying biology.
Precisely. You take a patient who is clinically diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Postmortem analysis very frequently shows they also had significant Lewy pathology or TDP43 aggregation, maybe even vascular issues. We call it mixed pathology.
So if your drug is designed to clear tau tangles, but the main problem is actually alpha-synuclein,
your drug will fail in that patient. It's the same in Parkinson's. A subset of clinically diagnosed PD patients, they never show the typical alpha-synuclein Lewy bodies at autopsy. Their neurodegeneration might be driven by something else entirely.
And this pathological mess then translates into completely different clinical presentations, the clinical heterogeneity.
Absolutely. The same disease label masks these drastically different outcomes. Look at PD again. You have patients whose main symptoms are motor dominant, the tremor, the rigidity.
Right.
And then you have others where the disease is non-motor dominant. They have severe cognitive dysfunction, autonomic failure, really early depression.
And those different presentations are just reflections of different biology.
The reflections of where the disease starts, how fast it spreads, and which neural circuits are getting hit the hardest. A drug that helps motor symptoms might do nothing for cognitive symptoms or, you know, even make them worse. The biology demands different approaches.
Okay, so we're moving deeper now from symptoms to the molecular drivers, the genetic and molecular diversity. This is where personalized models seem almost non-negotiable.
This is critical. We often talk about PD being either idiopathic or genetic, but even within the genetic patients, you have radically different diseases. A patient with an LRRK2 G2019S mutation is biologically distinct from one with a GBA N370S mutation. The LRRK2 mutation is all about kinase activity and mitochondrial function. The GBA mutation, on the other hand, it's about lysosomal dysfunction.
So even if they both look like Parkinson's in the clinic.
A therapy that boosts lysosomal function for the GBA patient is totally unlikely to help the LRRK2 patient who really needs mitochondrial support. If you group them together in a trial, the results will be confusing at best and probably negative.
And here's a concept that just really deepens the complexity. Misfolded protein diversity, or strains. It's not enough to target the protein. You have to target its specific shape.
This is one of the most exciting and, frankly, terrifying areas of discovery right now. Alpha-synuclein, tau, amyloid beta, we now know they all exist in different conformational variants, a bit like prions.
And these strains determine the pathology.
They do. Researchers have found distinct alpha-synuclein strains, for example. Let's call them strain 1 and strain 2. They propagate differently. Strain 1 might target the brainstem, leading to one clinical outcome, while strain 2 spreads aggressively into the cortex, causing rapid cognitive decline.
So if I developed an antibody that recognizes and neutralizes strain 1, and I put that drug into a phase 3 trial where half the patients have strain 2,
the efficacy is cut in half. Or maybe it's completely negated.
And the trial fails.
The trial fails, even if the drug works perfectly on strain 1 patients. The structural difference just prevents a uniform response. And just imagine trying to model that without cells that actually produce that patient's specific strain.
And we haven't even touched on the environment yet, which is where most of the sporadic cases come from. We have to consider these contextual factors.
The environmental profile is a huge modifier. Things like chronic exposure to toxins, pesticides linked to PD, for instance, diet, long-term stress, inflammation, they all interact with our genetics.
Right.
And microbiota dysbiosis is now a key player. It influences inflammation, how we produce metabolites, even how well certain drugs can cross the blood-brain barrier. Then you add comorbidities like cardiovascular disease or diabetes, which we know accelerate AD. It's a cascade.
It just fractures the patient groups into thousands of unique trajectories. So the major takeaway here is that our clinical trials are often failing, not because the drug is bad, but because we're failing at patient selection. We're running these heterogeneous trials way too late in the disease, grouping patients who are just fundamentally different at a cellular level.
That's it in a nutshell. Personalized medicine is the unavoidable response to that biological reality. Our job now is to use these advanced tools, these pillars we're about to discuss, to sort patients into meaningful biological subtypes. Define a cluster A, a cluster B, before we even design the therapy.
Okay, let's talk strategy then. You've defined five major domains, five pillars, where personalized medicine is being applied to NDDs.
Yes, and you have to think of these as an integrated system. They all reinforce each other.
So what's pillar number one?
Number one is personalized disease modeling. This is the foundation. Using iPSCs to capture a patient's unique genetic and cellular problems.
Okay, the model.
Number two, personalized tissue architecture. This is the next level of complexity, moving to organoids to recreate the cell interactions you find in real brain tissue.
So from the cell to the tissue, what's three?
Pillar three is personalized stratification and early detection. This is the clinical intelligence layer. It's about using AI and biomarkers to integrate all the data genomics, imaging, omics, to actually define those meaningful clusters, your cluster A, B, and C.
I see. So the models from one and two are used to test therapies for the clusters defined in three.
Precisely. Which brings us to pillar four, personalized therapeutics. This is where you develop and deliver things like genotype-based therapies or patient-matched cell therapy.
And the final pillar.
Personalized follow-up, using digital biomarkers, wearables, to track how an individual patient is progressing and responding to treatment in the real world outside of the clinic.
That structure really clarifies how the lab work directly informs the clinic. You can't get to pillar four, the treatment, unless you've mastered one and two, the models.
And crucially, pillar three, the patient stratification. The precision of your model has to match the precision of your diagnosis.
Which is why we're focusing so much today on those first two pillars.
Exactly. They provide the physical testing platform. To personalize the treatment, you first have to personalize the model. And that leads us straight to the tool that started this whole revolution, induced pluripotent stem cells.
iPSCs.
Right. The technology that Shinya Yamanaka developed back in 2007, which won him the Nobel Prize in 2012, it just fundamentally changed the landscape of disease modeling.
It's the closest thing we have to a biological time machine, right?
Right.
It lets us rewind an adult cell back to its most primitive state.
That's a good way to put it. Mechanistically, you take an adult somatic cell, so typically a fibroblast from a small skin biopsy, or even more commonly now, blood cells from a standard draw.
Okay.
And you use these core Yamanaka transcription factors to basically force this mature, differentiated cell back into a pluripotent state.
And once it's pluripotent, it's a blank slate. It can become any cell type in the central nervous system.
Any cell type. And this sidesteps all the significant ethical issues around embryonic stem cells while giving us a basically unlimited supply of human material.
An inexhaustible source of patient-specific cells.
Exactly. You can differentiate them into dopaminergic neurons, cortical neurons, astrocytes, microglia, whatever you need to study how that patient's specific genetic makeup is impacting their specific cell types.
But the power of this relies entirely on the quality of the source material. We need to talk about biobanks. These aren't just, you know, freezers full of cells. They're these huge data repositories.
They are absolutely vital. Centralized biobanks like the CBIESE catalog at the Neuro in Montreal, they are the backbone of this research.
And what makes them so valuable isn't just the cell lines themselves.
No, it's the fact that these lines are rigorously linked back to a massive amount of clinical data. Thousands of registered specimens, detailed MRI scans, neuropsych evaluations, long-term follow-up.
So when a researcher gets a cell line, they're not just getting a dish of neurons, they're getting a whole case file, a kind of digital twin of that patient's disease.
That's exactly what it is, yeah. And the specificity is just breathtaking. For Parkinson's, the catalog has lines for idiopathic PD, but also meticulously characterized genetic subtypes, LRRK2, GBA, even protective variants. It lets researchers ask incredibly specific questions.
And for anyone listening who's writing proposals right now, it's that linkage to the clinical data that makes these biobanks so priceless.
It's the connection to the phenotype that matters. And once you hit the line, which, you know, involves a detailed proposal and dual ethical approval, it can take 7 months or more, then you can perfect the model with genetic tools.
And this is where CRISPR-Cas9 comes in, to create what are called isogenic controls.
This is arguably the single greatest technical advantage of iPSCs for mechanistic studies. Let's say you have a patient line with a pathogenic SOG1 mutation for ALS.
Okay.
You can use CRISPR to go in and correct that single base pair error. That generates what we call an isogenic control line. It's genetically identical to the patient's cells in every single way, except for that one mutation you're studying.
It eliminates all the background genetic noise.
All of it. It allows us to say with confidence, this specific cellular problem is caused by this specific mutation.
Let's focus on the basic setup first, the 2D dish format. What power do we unlock when we grow these iPSCs in a simple monolayer?
The fundamental power is patient specificity. You preserve that patient's unique genetic background. That's essential for modeling diseases driven by all these complex combinations of mutations, risk variants, and modifiers.
And you can isolate specific cells.
Yes, you can study cell type vulnerability. We can differentiate the iPSCs into the precise cell type that's affected midbrain dopaminergic neurons for PD, motor neurons for ALS, and watch the early disease phenotypes emerge.
Like neurite shortening or protein accumulation.
Exactly, specifically within that vulnerable population. For instance, iPSC-derived dopaminergic neurons from PD patients consistently show these distinct PD-like vulnerabilities that cells from healthy controls just don't.
We've mentioned isogenic controls, but there's also the massive potential for drug discovery.
The unlimited expansion property is vital for that. They self-renew forever, so you can generate huge, stable, reproducible batches of cells.
Which is perfect for high-throughput screening.
Perfect for HTS. You can run thousands of chemical compounds through an assay designed to test a patient-specific defect, like restoring lysosomal function in a GBA line. And these platforms are already proving their worth, not just for finding drugs, but for driving cell replacement therapies that are now entering clinical trials.
But this incredible technical advantage, it comes at a huge biological price. This is the first thing students really need to internalize when they read an iPSC paper. We gain genetic precision, but we lose the history of the disease.
It is the single biggest hurdle, and the word for it is rejuvenation. The reprogramming process forces the cell back to an embryonic state, and in doing so, it erases decades of accumulated biological history.
What exactly gets wiped clean during this biological reset?
First, the original somatic epigenetic state is erased. The donor cell's unique epigenetic signature, all the DNA methylation and histone marks they've accumulated over 60 or 70 years, it's reset.
And that landscape is how the environment regulates our genes.
Yes. So you can't reliably use these cells to study the epigenetic landscape of the original patient.
And losing that epigenetic history directly leads to the loss of age-related features.
Absolutely. The iPSCs are biologically young. All the critical hallmarks of late-onset disease are gone. Telomere shortening, mitochondrial aging, the signatures of epigenetic clocks. If an 80-year-old with Alzheimer's donates a skin cell, the neuron we grow from it is genetically 80 years old, but biologically it's more like a fetal neuron.
And modeling a disease of aging in a juvenile cell is a massive limitation.
A severe limitation.
So we have to artificially age them. How are people trying to do that?
It's a really intense area of research. A common way is through accelerated stress protocols. So you hit the cells with chronic low-level oxidative stress or mitochondrial toxins to sort of force them into an aged state.
And more sophisticated ways.
There are techniques like transiently expressing progerin, which is a protein that causes premature aging, or manipulating signaling pathways linked to senescence.
But there's a trade-off, right?
The challenge is you get an aged phenotype, but you lose certainty. How accurate is that forced aging compared to the natural 70-year process? We might be losing crucial biological fidelity by rushing it.
And you also lose the specific environmental imprints that shape that patient.
Yes. The chronic effects of their lifestyle diet, neurotoxin exposure, stress, which primarily influence the epigenome, are gone. The model just can't reflect the patient's lived environmental history.
And finally, there are just the basic model limitations of 2D culture itself.
A flat dish is a forced environment. It imposes this unnatural organization. It restricts cell interactions. It removes all the natural chemical gradients. It severely limits our ability to study complex things like demyelination or how glia and neurons really communicate in a tissue.
This critique of 2D models leads us directly to the next level then, 3D modeling. If 2D models nail the genetics but give us a juvenile, flat cell, what's the next design flaw we have to overcome?
The immediate flaw is the complete absence of anatomical structure and complexity, and we address this with organoids. This is the leap from personalized disease modeling to personalized tissue architecture.
So what are they exactly?
Organoids are 3D self-assembling structures that we derive from those same patient iPSCs, and they mimic the complex organization and cellular diversity of specific regions of the human brain.
We hear them called mini-brains, but they're obviously much simpler than that.
Mini-tissue structures is probably a more cautious and accurate description, but they are a quantum leap in realism compared to a 2D dish.
So what's the first big advantage?
The first major gain is cellular diversity and interactions. Organoids integrate multiple cell types, neurons, astrocytes, oligodendrocyte precursors. You can even actively integrate patient-derived microglia into them.
So you can study the crosstalk between cells.
Exactly. The complex interactions that drive neurodegeneration, how reactive astrocytes damage neurons, or how inflammatory microglia respond to protein aggregates, all in a structure that approximates real tissue.
And you can customize them for the specific brain region where a disease starts.
That's essential. We can achieve regional and network features. We can grow dorsal cortical organoids for Alzheimer's studies, ventral midbrain organoids for Parkinson's, or spinal cord organoids for ALS.
Which is key for modeling selective vulnerability.
Crucial for it. Why are motor neurons in the spine targeted in ALS, while dopaminergic neurons in the substantia nigra are targeted in PD? That regional specificity is almost impossible to replicate accurately in a simple 2D culture.
And the 3D structure itself must be better for studying disease progression, especially something like protein spreading.
Absolutely. They enable long-term culture. You can maintain organoids for many months, which makes them ideal for studying these slow, chronic NDD processes. We can actually watch the gradual accumulation and spread of misfolded proteins.
So like tau or alpha-synuclein moving from cell to cell?
Yes, spreading across synaptic connections within that 3D network. It's a phenomenon you just can't capture effectively in a monolayer. And on top of that, they start to develop network formation. They show early, measurable electrical activity, which lets us look at circuit-level problems.
So it facilitates that cell-to-cell communication in a much more realistic way.
In a way that much more closely resembles the in vivo environment, all while keeping that patient's unique genetic fingerprint.
What's fascinating here is that while organoids solve the architecture problem of 2D because they come from iPSCs, they inherit the exact same core limitation.
They absolutely carry the same baggage, and the biggest hurdle remains immaturity and aging.
They're still young.
They're still biologically young. The iPSCs were rejuvenated, so the resulting organoid is too. Even after 6 months of growth, they structurally resemble fetal brain tissue, not adult tissue, and definitely not aged tissue. For late-onset NDDs, this is still the single greatest challenge to Fugality.
And the architecture, even though it's complex, is still limited because it's in a dish.
Yes. It lacks a fully functional physiological infrastructure. They're missing a full vasculature and a native immune system.
So they have trouble getting nutrients.
Right. The lack of oxygen and nutrient diffusion in that dense 3D structure often leads to necrotic or hypoxic cores. They struggle to mature completely, especially in the inner layers.
And no immune system is a huge problem for diseases like AD.
It's a severe limitation. We can add microglia from the outside, but modeling the complex dynamic role of the neurovascular unit and systemic inflammation is extremely challenging.
And finally, their very complexity creates technical headaches.
It does. We run into major technical challenges. The growth protocols are so complex that you get significant batch-to-batch variability, which limits reproducibility between experiments and labs.
And they're hard to analyze.
They are. The thick 3D structure complicates everything. Drug penetration is hard to measure. Advanced imaging is tough because of light scattering. And critically, doing any kind of reliable, high-throughput analysis, electrophysiology, automated assays is far more difficult than in a simple 2D monolayer.
So we've essentially traded high-throughput scalability for physiological realism.
That's the trade-off, which means 2D and 3D models aren't competing. They have to work together.
So what does this all mean for a researcher right now? We have these two incredibly powerful tools, 2D iPSCs and 3D organoids, but both have this major caveat about erasing the patient's biological history, especially their age. Where does the field go from here?
The path forward is really defined by complementarity and integration. These models are not rivals. They're part of an ecosystem.
So 2D cultures still have a major role.
Oh, absolutely. They will remain the workhorse platform because they are scalable, they're reproducible, and they're excellent for mechanistic clarity. If you're studying a specific signaling pathway or you need to quantify protein aggregation, 2D is perfect.
And for drug screening?
Indispensable for high-throughput drug screening, like the platforms used to screen tens of thousands of compounds for potential synucleinopathy treatments.
And the 3D organoids provide the necessary context for those findings.
They are essential for physiological realism, for studying tissue-level, circuit-based, and cell-cell interaction mechanisms. Things like watching tau pathology spread across a network or quantifying synaptic deficits that only show up in a layered structure.
But the real power here isn't just in the model. It's knowing which patient that model represents. And that brings us back to pillar three, personalized stratification using AI and biomarkers.
This is the crucial translational step. The future strategy is all about integrating complex clinical data to define meaningful biological subtypes before we even look at the models.
And AI is essential for that.
A human eye simply cannot synthesize the volume of data we generate. We feed the AI massive amounts of multimodal data. So high-resolution neuroimaging like PET scans showing amyloid or tau load, deep genetic sequencing, biochemical data from cerebrospinal fluid, and critically, omics data transcriptomics and metabolomics.
Why are the omics data so important for clustering these patients?
Because transcriptomics tells you which genes are actually being expressed, and metabolomics tells you which metabolic pathways are functionally broken. So the AI might identify a cluster A based not just on their GBA mutation, but also a specific signature of impaired lipid processing and a specific pattern of lysosomal gene expression.
So the AI defines cluster A based on its functional pathology, not just the clinical label of Parkinson's.
Exactly. Once cluster A is defined by, say, prominent lysosomal dysfunction, we then pull the iPSC lines from patients in that cluster. We confirm the lysosomal problem in their 2D neurons.
And then use those cells to screen for a drug.
And then we use those 2D cultures for high-throughput screening to find a compound that specifically rescues that lysosomal deficit. That compound becomes drug A, targeted only for cluster A patients.
Instead of aiming one drug at 1,000 different diseases, we're developing a highly targeted therapeutic for a defined biological subtype.
That is the goal of personalized drug discovery. We move toward genotype-based therapeutics, like antisense oligonucleotides to silence a toxic gene, or cell therapy tailored to the individual. It's the only way to get around the heterogeneity hurdle that has plagued us for decades.
This has been a deeply insightful look into this whole shift in NDD research. The ability to grow a patient's unique disease in a dish, to really confront that diversity head-on, it seems like the crucial bridge being built right now.
It is. And as you move forward in your own research, here's something to think about. If the greatest limitation of these models, both 2D and 3D, is the loss of the patient's age and environmental history.
The rejuvenation problem.
And we are forced to artificially induce aging using these techniques like chronic stress or expressing progerin. How much biological fidelity are we inherently losing by forcing a decades-long process into a matter of weeks?
And how do we even validate that?
How will we ever validate that the artificially aged cell accurately models the pathology of an 80-year-old compared to a cell that aged naturally? The answer to that question will define the next decade of NDD model development.
Something critical for you to consider as you design your next experiments. Thank you for diving deep with us.